You're listening to Dr. Anne West on Truth from the Source, bringing you cutting-edge interviews discussing important life, health, environmental, and metaphysical issues that could affect the well-being of our lives. Join me every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on bbsradio.com. Truth from the Source. I'm Dr. Anne West, and this is my debut show with BBS Radio, and I'm so happy to be able to say I have Marilyn Ferguson, author of The Aquarian Spiracy, a book that was very, very popular earlier on in the century, and she has sold over 2.5 million copies of that book, and Marilyn is back with more incredible cutting-edge information, Aquarius Now, Radical Common Sense, and Reclaiming Our Personal Sovereignty. Marilyn, welcome to Truth from the Source.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. You've been such at the spearhead of a movement now throughout not only the United States, but I think worldwide, helping people to understand what this age is all about. And maybe I'll explain what Aquarius Now is all about and moving into that age.
Well, in a way, I think that I've been trying to help myself understand what it's all about, too, because, you know, there's always revision and going on.
I think we teach what we need to know the most, don't you?
Well, it's if we only talk about the things that we really truly understand, we wouldn't have much to talk about. So I think of it as kind of an exploration that I found that I've noticed, and I think that I mentioned this to you the other day, that it seems as if some of us who think about these things, that we get these very parallel, almost identical realizations, like the same week or the same day or
yes,
whatever. It's like there is some kind, we subscribe to some kind of an email service that's sending these off every once in a while.
And then when we get it in threes, then we know it's time to stop everything and listen.
Yeah, I mean, you hate to admit that it's that much of a hunch kind of thing, but after all, that's where all, every breakthroughs come, every scientific breakthrough, and every insight, I think.
Marilyn, what was the purpose of this second book? I know that with The Aquarian Conspiracy, you had an unfathomable success with that book. You didn't even know yourself how many people would want to know about what you had to write about.
I didn't realize how many people were thinking along the same lines.
Yes.
And that was exciting to find out. I also didn't realize how really challenging it is for us to start to do things differently.
Yes.
We get the bad news.
Yes.
Well, the purpose of Aquarius Now, I was calling it for a long time Radical Common Sense, which is in the subtitle. And it was, what's going on here? You know, given, you know, there was this cute little old German smart remark about, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? Well, given what we know about our capacities and our potential and all this dramatic stuff, if we're so rich, why ain't we smart? You know, how is it, you know, we can see it easier when it's these big collective actions like governments and whatnot and industries. But you think, how can we keep shooting ourselves in the foot? And individually, somebody said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
Right.
That there's an awful lot of wishful thinking that goes on. And I think it's somehow, or maybe it's hopeful thinking. Well, I hope I get better. I hope I quit doing that. But in a way, there is a parallel of it that should really get us on our feet, which is that it isn't just that there are these little things that we don't deal with, that we know are not quite right, and that we're not living up to whatever. But I think that we have no idea how incredible we can be and our impact can be if we start to do that. I mean, that's what we need is that motivation. It's like, oh boy, it's going to be better than you thought.
I think that part of the answer to what you were just asking about, you know, why aren't we rich if we're so smart? Why aren't we smart if we're so rich? Is I think that we like to get into our comfort zones and then we go into denial that there's even a problem going on.
Isn't it strange about human beings? I mean, you think of a little kid. I mean, I have never seen a conformist 3 or 4 year old. I've never seen a kid at that age who was not imaginative, because whose misunderstandings are you going to make up? You know? Everybody's thinking for himself, herself.
Mm-hmm.
And educators from a number of different fields and at different times have concluded that it's at about age 9 that children's creativity declines, and that's a pretty sad thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have this capacity, and little children, if you think about when you were little, they didn't call it learning, but you loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And how we somehow kind of like stumbled our way and grandfathered ourselves into these ideas that have caused us to turn people against learning or discovery or novelty, which is the thing that we're built to follow.
Yes, I think we have a system in the West that tampers with that innate drive that we have when we're born as children.
Well, I think that we're probably pretty far out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when my mother was a child, I saw one of her school books. And by the time I was going to the first grade, and it has happened ever since, it's like See Dick Run, Spot, and,
yes, yes,
and all this. When my mother was a child, they gave them books full of wonderful stories, legends and myths and fairy tales. And,
yes.
That would make you want to read. You'd have a reason.
Right.
And I think that somehow that it's the imagination that has maybe been underestimated. That, so it's not engaging. What is wrong with being entertaining? The best preachers I ever heard were entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the best teachers, the best college teachers. It's because if people are really engaged in it and they have thought about, okay, what turns me on, and then they share that with you. So I think that we have it in us. We have it in us to do some kind of across the board changes. And the good bad news is we have no choice.
We have to do it.
Yeah. Somebody said, if it weren't for the last minute, nothing would ever get done.
That's right. We've got a Mack truck coming down the road at us, and we're looking at, you know, how do we get off the road and out of the way? And
right. It's no longer, it would be nice if I did the right thing.
Uh-huh.
It's, we've painted ourselves into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing left to do is the right thing. The old idealism is the new common sense. We've tried out that other stuff, and it just gets so complicated. I mean, the first cook doesn't stand a chance, if you know what I mean.
Do you think that, I mean, we do have the time, and we do have the ability to turn things around now planetarily,
but not much left over, I think.
We're really butting up against the line now. And I mean, I know that you're extremely optimistic. I know that you believe that we can do it, and I do too. Will we do it? We're going to have a certain amount of us who will be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it already.
Yeah, and I think what people need to stop and think is that almost everything that has. Okay, like people say, well, I wouldn't do this if other people didn't, but what's the point of me stopping if
mm-hmm.
nobody else is going to stop?
Right.
And so that everybody does it kind of thing that went on for so long.
Right.
But the common sense tells you that eventually all those people thinking that way could run us into a situation where there's no, I mean, past the point of no return.
Mm-hmm.
And so, It's almost as if the sensible thing and the right thing is that without having to stop and think who else is recycling or who else is not wasting fuel or who is not well, being a hypocrite or you know, gossiping or cheating or whatever the things are that we wouldn't want anybody to notice that we were doing it. And that we don't, it's like it's me. It's me and my standards. It's not a competition. Right? It's not 51% of the people. And I'll tell you something interesting. And when I wrote The Aquarian Conspiracy, I didn't know diddly about astrology, and I don't know a whole lot more than diddly now. But I used the word Aquarian because the song from Hair, The Age of Aquarius, this is a really very moving song, very popular. And I noticed that everywhere I went in the world, I mean, you could be in Venice, you could be in Tokyo, wherever, and somewhere somebody's playing that song. And I thought, well, we can't have a world that we can't envision, in a positive sense, that we can't even imagine. So the idea that people are in love with the idea of the time of the mind's true liberation struck me as being a hopeful sign. And, you know, there's some of the lyrics have to do with when this or that moves into Aquarius and whatnot. And it's, you know, beautifully done. There have been a number of alignments. But it's never been quite clear among astrologers. There's not been any agreement for sure about when the age of Aquarius begins. Well, I got to thinking about this stuff one day about, somebody told me that there was a new book, which I have not yet been able to find, no matter how cleverly I tried to Google for it, that said that 35 world religions had deemed this time approximately as an end time in their prophecies. I thought that was interesting because I knew that the Hopi Indian prophecy was pretty current. And in fact, it had was geared around the birth of the white buffalo, which had happened in Wisconsin about it. Time I was thinking about this, and the Native Americans, almost all the tribes had this part of the prophecy that goes back to when their genocide was basically prophesied, that there would come a time when it would all turn the other way, and the young people of the conquerors would turn to them for wisdom. There was the Aztecs had an like prophecy of the end of the world of the dark sun, which would be a transition of consciousness around 1990, I think. And I think by now probably everybody knows that the Mayan prophecy was 2012, the end of a 24,000-year period. The Christians always like focused around the millennium and, in fact, didn't expect to survive the millennium at 1,000. And Jesus, I mean, there was the fact that the astrologers weren't too sure about this age of Aquarius, this date, and that Jesus said, speaking of, he didn't call it the second coming, but whatever. That it would come like a thief in the night and no man knows. And I don't know how the Sufi mystical branch of Islam has it, but basically the idea is that Allah only knows. And I was thinking, well, now what are we talking about here? It's interesting if 35 world religions were right around roughly the same time. And yet, you know, is this a date or is it not? And all of a sudden, I don't know where it came from, I thought, it's not a date. It's a decision. That
enough
I live
enough.
In the age of Aquarius and you live in the age of Aquarius when we deem it has dawned. That, yes, approximately now, roughly now, but you know, there is free will running around. And I think that when you think of it that way, it was like, yeah, this is an ideal. This is a time that we're dreaming of. Why don't we just live it now? And to my great surprise, because I was intrigued with this idea, I still decided I better know a little bit more about it. So I started doing searches on the web, and I discovered that the modern interest in the idea of an age of Aquarius, of an age of Aquarius, came from Carl Jung. Who was not, I mean, he was an amateur astrologer. And Jung had picked up the idea from another writer whose name I forget, who got it from my favorite turn of the last century visionary, Edward Carpenter, So it was basically something that was embraced by these kind of creative, intuitive people
mm-hmm.
as almost as a compelling myth. And that made it even more, well, do we go for it or do we not?
Right.
So
and we have
like,
to go forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the idea, the fact that the musical, the song and the musical caught hold of people and so on, who's going to argue? Who knows? Like that film says, what the bleep do we know?
Mm-hmm.
So we might as well go with the thing that looks like it's going to be the most productive.
We're moving forward at such a rapid pace as well, and people are waking up and they're becoming familiar with the terms in the movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? They're waking up. Do you believe in the 100th Monkey effect, Marilyn?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting thing about the 100th Monkey story. It is in part true, in part not true. The fellow who reported on it, Lyle Watson, is a biologist. He lives in the same village I was living in for several months in Ireland.
Uh-huh.
And he put the story out there embellishing the facts somewhat because he thought it was a charming idea. It was true that on certain islands there was a young female monkey who began washing the sand off her yams and rinsing them in the ocean, that several of the other young ones did it and some of the older ones picked it up. And that had been written up.
Mm-hmm.
It was not true that suddenly the same day on all those other islands the same thing happened. And I kind of scolded Lyle a little bit for that. Well, it just seemed like it was a good idea. However, there's other research, basically, that verifies it. In the 1920s, there was a Harvard researcher who was studying rats and mazes, and water mazes. And he noticed that some of the rats, he thought maybe they were inheriting this knowledge because some of the rats were running it correctly the first time, you know, as generations of the same breeds.
Yeah.
And so other researchers decided to see if they could replicate it, and they replicated it with different breeds of rats.
Oh.
And eventually it was found that, I mean, it had gotten into rat consciousness, this water maze. Rupert Sheldrake, a plant biologist, an Englishman, I think was living in India when he got these ideas, he had heard about that and supported a notion that he had. He had gotten this idea that maybe the universe doesn't so much have laws as habits.
Uh-huh.
And that if something happens, it tends to cause other things to happen in the same way. And it would be like one of those intersections where there's one bad accident after another.
Uh-huh.
And so when he glommed onto this research on the rats in the water maze, as that certainly fit his model. And the thing he had conjectured was that it ought to affect crystals, too. It's very hard, apparently, to get the first organic crystal. You know, like a lot of scientists in different labs can be working on it. But once one of them has gotten it, it seems to be easy for everybody else to do it. And the crystallographers or whatever that specialty was had, to try to explain it to themselves, had said, well, maybe the visiting scientists from the original lab had got some on their suits or in their beards and it had fallen off. You know, and we get pretty far-fetched sometimes when we're trying to explain things like this. What Rupert proposes, and there have since been some other experiments that have borne out his ideas, is he talks about morphic resonance. That the resonant field of something then creates, it's like beyond time and space, it tends to cause other things to happen like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it fits with, it not only fits with some of the more like esoteric physics and stuff, but also with metaphysical tradition that, you know, the person as a seed crystal,
mm-hmm.
as above, so below. And so I think, you know, I had a friend in Los Angeles who did beautiful work of making things of crystals and sculpting them, and he was also a mineralogist, a crystallographer. Mm-hmm. And he said, how the crystals work with healing is it's actually our consciousness going through them. And we are also crystalline in some form. He said, in nature, whatever is the most highly organized drives the lower orders. And so the crystal is a really organized thing.
Uh-huh.
And we have crystalline structures in us. So it's like if you put a whole lot of pendulum-type clocks on a wall, eventually they will all be at the same time because they're driven by the clock that has the strongest drive.
Uh-huh.
So there are ways to get where we have to go besides having one wholesale conversion after another.
Do you know what I mean? Like women, when they live in the same house, they eventually start
That's right. They have
their period on the same day.
Well, if a man lives with a woman and she's not on the pill, he shares the cycles that she has. I mean, there's
that's
stuff
what's
like
going
that
on
that
with my husband.
There's stuff there's, and then there was something even more far out that I heard recently, but it was a new finding. So we are each other. I mean, it's not just something that the Hindus talk about.
Yes, we definitely do share our own energetic fields.
Well, one thing I thought was interesting is that it occurred to me one day that we have the same composition of water, 80% of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
We have all these same minerals.
Yes.
Recently, somebody said, did you know that our pH of our water is the same as the earth?
Huh.
And
our
I thought, well,
the
maybe,
same...
just like James Lovelock has this idea that the earth is a Gaia is a being, maybe every little one of us, every one of us is an earth.
Our own individual earth.
And if they're fighting in the Middle East, it might be giving me indigestion. You know, I joke about it, but I think that we can't run away from the fact that, I mean, nobody is a clever enough hermit
mm-hmm.
or recluse to not be affected by the field.
And also, being isolated as a hermit is actually extremely detrimental for the heart.
Do you remember some years ago they found that newborn babies who were not touched died?
Yes, they died.
They actually needed to be touched.
Absolutely.
Right. And so, I mean, there's no getting around. There's something called the Global Consciousness Project,
uh-huh.
which is so amazing. I'm surprised more people don't know about it. It started with some research at Princeton maybe 20 years ago. The dean of engineering and a couple people on his staff were curious about what they called man-machine anomalies. You know how some people affect electronic equipment?
Yes.
They're around or affect the lights and so on.
Yes.
So they started to study it. And after a while, they wanted to have a way to establish something that didn't require the experimenter to know it, because then somebody could read his mind. So they used random number generators,
mm-hmm.
which are based on radioactive decay.
Uh-huh.
And after some years of doing that, they discovered by accident that if there was a big emotional meeting that was happening in the vicinity, that the random number generators deviated from the randomness and began to show patterns. And so that idea grew and grew and grew, and now there are random number generators in 24 time zones, the 24 time zones in the
mm-hmm.
world, and their findings are fed into these large computers that people have loaned time on, and the Global Consciousness Project, which derived from that study at Princeton,
mm-hmm.
You can make a prediction, like, let's say, Princess Diana's funeral, you want them to check that. And they find that any time something major happens, it could be winning a World Cup, it can be a death, it can be a major political event.
Yes.
That it registers.
And it registers.
Deviations into patterns.
Huh. So they can actually tell from looking at these patterns. I have heard about this. I interviewed Greg Braden, and he was telling me about the same thing, and he said that they even registered it before
the earthquake in Turkey, 10 minutes before.
They had registered that there was going to be something and didn't know what it was, but there was going to be something enormous
people
to affect the planet.
Have you lived through an earthquake?
Yes.
Well, you know, there is that feeling just before they happen. Some people, quite a lot of people I know, get it hours ahead of time, but they're just before it happens. I remember the first time I was in one in California, dogs started to howl and stuff. But there's like this electrical feeling, this energy, and probably the animals, if nothing else, were aroused, and that there was some big vibe that came up just before it happened.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I think one of the reasons that you tend not to be, I don't find the earthquakes frightening because you are so engaged in the now.
Yes.
You don't have time to even be frightened. You're just watching, you know, is this
yes.
a big one or is...
You know, when you talk about this, it reminds me of the Northridge earthquake when I was in California.
Yes.
And I had a dream before it telling me the size of it to move from my home into another home. It
mm-hmm.
was so clear. I woke up, my heart was pounding out of my chest, and I thought, gosh, how much weight do I put on a dream? How much, because I mean, this dream told me to move out of my home.
Uh-huh.
At that time, I was living...
How long far ahead?
I had 3 months.
Uh-huh.
3 months. And I woke up, and I thought, you know, I mean, I was in a cold sweat. My heart was pounding. I thought I was having a heart attack. And
did you do it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I did. I moved and moved the children out of their schools. I moved. I did everything. And then I was in my new home. I moved to Thousand Oaks, and I had been living in Granada Hills,
uh-huh.
which was very close to the Northridge Epic Center.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I moved to Thousand Oaks because it's granite. It's
uh-huh.
solid rock. And found a beautiful new home. Got reestablished, and the day that I got everything organized, I sat in my kitchen alone, and I broke down into tears thinking, what have I done? I changed everybody's life because of a dream that I had.
Uh-huh.
And then I started to disbelieve the fact that I had done that, and then that night, when I was sound asleep, the earthquake hit.
Yeah,
and
hit
that
like
whole street that we lived on was condemned.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I where does that come from, Marilyn? You know, these.
Well, I know many people that I know said that they knew several hours before
uh-huh.
The Northridge quake and the previous one. I can't remember which one that was. And now they didn't have to move their family because they weren't on a major fault.
Yes.
But I tell you an interesting little earthquake story here. I was speaking at, where was I? Oh, it was in Topanga Canyon, and it was a place that was still then, it was a nudist camp, famous nudist camp called Elysium.
Oh, Elysium. I know that place.
And, but they had a building that you could rent for meetings. It was near the
yes.
entrance, and you didn't have to be a member of the
yes, meetings. You could do the workshop.
And there was a group of people who were in Los Angeles who were followers of a Ugandan spiritual teacher trained in India named Bambi Baba.
Uh-huh.
And he had gone back to Uganda. And they asked me if I would come to this gathering they were having. Some of them were from, maybe a third of them were black people, some from New York, some from the LA area, and there were a lot of European non-blacks and South Americans and whatnot that were part of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd asked me if I would give an invocation at this thing. And I said, well, if somebody doesn't mind giving me a ride, okay. And it was kind of a strange coincidence because my daughter and son-in-law who lived with me were going later to visit friends. It turned out to be like right next to this place. I was able to get a ride back with them and
yeah.
stay until midnight. But anyway, when I got there, and it was time for me to do my thing. Now, I'm a Lutheran and our invocations are probably not like what they were expecting, but I figured I'll wing it. So I'm talking about their spiritual teacher and my meeting with him, very interestingly. And that I had come to think that he was right and that we should support him in his idea of clearing the waters and the ether of the earth.
Uh-huh.
Now, I sometimes walk around when I'm talking. And everybody in the room got this very weird look. And I stopped, and somebody said, didn't you feel that there was just an earthquake when you said Earth? And I hadn't, you know. And the people that from that organization started calling me, Earthquake Maryland or something like that.
Earthquake Mother.
Anyway, other people had come in, just before that had happened. No, but it was afterwards. More people came in. Some of the nudists were curious and put their clothes on, and they came in. And naturally, they were pretty comfortable people. There was a lot of talk. And I talked about how Bambi Bamba had asked, he thought it would be a good idea if Los Angeles could be like a sister city to the city he was starting on the lake shores of Lake Victoria.
Uh-huh.
And there had been a lot of coincidences. Lake Victoria and the place, the people who invited him and his entourage to stay were in the section of L.A. called Victoria. And they have their, what is that source of our, not Howell, but something anyway, the name of their main source of drinking water is the same as in L.A. And so I said, I'll tell you what, let's everybody just close your eyes. We're going to do this kind of meditation. And I would like you to picture Los Angeles. Would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and I'm thinking to myself, I had just seen the sight of the city. I had just accidentally stumbled upon it in Legion Park. And so, anyway, we did that, and then we went on and whatever. But Los Angeles is, and I mentioned something about the founding of the city and blah, blah, blah. And so that was that. There was some big alignment of planets on Tuesday night, and some of those people came up and whatnot. I had asked Ingo Swann, who is a famous psychic in New York and also an astrologer to amuse himself,
mm-hmm.
What was coming up with this alignment of planets. And he said, oh, no big deal. People are always making a fuss about it. Then he called me back and he said, no, I was wrong. This is an alignment of seven planets. And it hasn't happened since this particular thing. Oh, seven planets, I think, in Aquarius, and it hadn't happened. Oh, Capricorn, hadn't happened since 1886, and before that, 1870.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually quite unusual. And he said, now, when a lot of heavy planets are aligned in Capricorn, there's a tendency to earthquakes.
Mm.
Well, we were still having. I forgot to say, the next morning after I did that thing with them, the Los Angeles Times had a headline that said that an earthquake that was centered in Santa Monica Bay struck, and that was what we felt.
Yes.
And it had started in Legion Park, which was where the site was at the founding of L.A. And so I thought that was strange. Anyway, I guess Saturday morning, there comes the quake.
Wow.
Big air earthquake, and when heavy planets were aligning Capricorn.
Huh.
And the earthquake actually made LA more like what people would have liked, because it closed off the Santa Monica Freeway and people had to drive through neighborhoods. There was no smog at all for months. You could see the mountains clearly.
Interesting.
So I think that if we think of ourselves as possibly interacting meaningfully with stars and planets and other people and the story, it's just such a good story.
Mm-hmm. When you said how would you like to imagine Los Angeles, the first thing I saw was a clear blue sky.
Uh-huh.
Instead of a brown haze, and then that's what your visualization group actually.
The freeway broke it. The 10
mm-hmm.
freeway broke it on La Cienega, and so forget it. You know, that was the first that I realized that the dirt, the mess, just went up the freeway and curved around and up to the mountains by Pasadena. But yeah, it's I think that they're, you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Huh.
They had been close, they had been alienated, they had become friends again. And the largest piece of the Schumacher-Levy comet hit Jupiter on the 25th anniversary of our walk on the moon. to the 20th or 25th, I forget. And it was like, even Stephen Jay Gould, who the Smithsonian, all the nature stuff, and he'd been kind of a skeptic, he had to say that that gave him pause. But supposing we're wrong, so what? Isn't it more interesting to attribute meaning to what's going on?
Absolutely. I wish that, because obviously, you know, you're talking about having people do these visualizations and they're extremely powerful. We know that prayer works. We've had science research it and say that when people come together and put their minds together, that we can create something wonderful. We can change things. How do you feel about the leaders we have today, Marilyn, in regards to where are our visionary leaders?
Well, there are leaders and then there are leaders. The mm-hmm. ones who should be speaking up more loudly and confidently, either they're feeling silenced or they're not. You know, I think that they're trying to get it together to know what to do in the face of this very stifling national, what would you call it, this national doldrums that we have been under.
Yes.
And the fact that we are, if we were in show business or we had been entrepreneurs or something like that, people would be calling us a has-been. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, they make it back.
Yeah.
And regardless of how powerful we think we are. And I think that here's how, basically, the way I deal with the worst of it, and it does seem to me to be true. I believe that Shakespeare was right, all the world's a stage, and we're characters upon it, and that players upon it, and yes. that if we follow the world events, the national events, and even the events go closer to home, we can see that this is just one big human story. That it's as if things are enacted in the glare of the limelight for us to get the picture. That then Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who came to America in the 1830s to see what this democracy was like and wrote a famous book about it called Democracy in America.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he would be surprised if a people so materialistic did not become spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that to the Europeans and some others, it seems like we're certainly preoccupied with these religious issues.
Extremely kind of. Preoccupied. And so
and
much
I think
so.
That maybe instead of thinking of ourselves as being, you know, liberals or fundamentalists or whatever, it's like one way or another, we're certainly interested in the bigger picture.
Absolutely. Now, your subtitle, Radical Common Sense and Reclaiming Our Personal Sovereignty, Marilyn, is a very bold statement for us to be able to move into that. I would love to think that we can reclaim our personal sovereignty. How do you assume that the sovereignty of ourselves as individuals, how do we assume that again? What would that look like?
Well, I think it has to do with simple, what appear to be simple acts. Rosa Parks, unlike the stories that were told about her not getting up from the bus seat,
yes.
It wasn't because she was tired and she worked hard. She had made up her mind that if she was ever asked to give up her seat to a white person, she wouldn't do it.
Yes.
And because she was active in these groups of people that were, you know, looking for more justice.
Yes.
And, you know, she wasn't going to make a big deal about it, but that was what she did. It was a simple thing. And I think it's like the most recent edition of Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, which is like this classic collection of famous quotations, included a few new ones. And one of them was a letter that had been found from Einstein written to a friend during the period of the McCarthy hearings. And Einstein said, if American intellectuals don't have what it takes to just absolutely refuse to participate in this, then they will deserve what they get.
Mm.
That he could see having come from Germany, you know, where that was leading.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of the Russian dissidents, talking about, I think which one, Sharansky maybe, but Boris Pasternak, who wrote Dr. Zhivago. He said there was a point in which everybody was, he was really in trouble, and none of us stood up for him. And I have felt so bad about that. So, I mean, I think almost everybody has somebody in their life that they have an opportunity to stand up for.
Yes.
I mean, supposing that some third party starts attacking somebody that you know, are you going to stick up for them? You know, I think that comfort thing you were talking about, it's easier not to. But if the people who did that kind of thing, if it happened to them a few times that somebody else had something to say about it, they would be too embarrassed to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. And checking in with ourselves and with our integrity, if, you know, and finding our own integrity.
Yeah, yeah.
Finding it.
Like, I was thinking about that feeling, you know, the feeling that we call regret.
Oh,
it has a physical component,
yes.
Right? There's a, you know, feel it in your body. So I figure if it's got a physical component, there's some natural purpose to it. And probably it was just meant to notify us that we might want to think about what just happened.
Right. And we might not
that's
want
all
to
we have
recreate
to
it.
Just notice.
Uh-huh.
That I think people don't realize, most people haven't had the liberating realization that if you just notice, a lot of stuff takes care of itself. I mean, you don't have to swear or vow or whatever.
I love the idea of following our bliss, because when we follow our bliss, we're really walking the path of the soul.
Yes. Yes.
And
somebody said, one of my friends said the other day, I follow my quirkiness, which is bliss, that the thing that catches your attention, you know, it's like something rings your bell.
Yes.
And I guess it's kind of a paradox, because in a way, if you are a person seeking justice, following your bliss could mean following a pattern of an injustice.
This is, yes, yes. And being blind, of course. And there's a loophole in there.
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe people are a little confused because of all of the, you know, like the American dream is a misnomer. It's being abused, the expression, because it's come to mean to you know, buy a house and get a good job. And the American dream was about the freedom to dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this business about, are we there yet? Am I happy? Usually when you're happiest, you're unselfconscious, you're in the flow. You're not asking. If you're asking, you know, it's like you interrupted the flow.
Mm-hmm.
That it's more a matter of, am I engaged? Do I feel alive? Don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, when you are engaged and you're actually integrating with your community, with the society around you, and you're a part of that, then you can hear and feel what's going on outside of your own little world.
Mm-hmm.
And take
it's,
yourself
it's
out.
It's like you're more alive.
Isolation.
People are mistaken if they think they'll be happier if they like cut themselves off from evidence of wrongdoing or unhappiness, because you just go dead.
Now, when we're talking about having this following our bliss, and then some people having their bliss checking out in something that's out of integrity, that's where what you're talking about with radical common sense comes in. And, you know, we've all heard of common sense growing up. We've heard, well, it's just common sense that they know this. It's just common sense that you should do that. And common sense to me as a child was something that I was supposed to have. I was told I had.
Coming in out of the rain, I think, was one.
Yeah. And yet it's kind of like, well, how do you put your finger on that?
Well, it's kind of interesting because common sense, or people would say, how come common sense is so uncommon? Well, because actually what it originally meant in English, was common among your senses. It was what you knew when you checked in with your hearing and your seeing and your feeling and your gut and everything.
Mm-hmm.
That was common among your senses. That was common sense. It's kind of like consensus, I guess.
Yeah.
But somehow my assistant, Paul Kobe, had, I don't know, we were throwing around phrases, and he had heard me say, or he said, or something, he could bring up radical common sense, and I suddenly realized he was suggesting it as a title for what we were doing.
Uh-huh.
And it was perfect in a way, because radical doesn't mean extreme or far out. It means far in. It means the essence of something, the roots of it, like the radish is a root, and radii. And it's like originally meant the juice in the fruits and vegetables, and then it came to mean the juice or the essence of anything. So radical common sense is like the essence of what it is we know deeply, internally, inwardly.
Uh-huh.
And so many of the things, think of all of the problems, like education, that we keep trying and trying, and it gets worse and worse. Well, maybe we're doing the wrong thing. If you keep not getting a good result, then maybe you need to look 180 degrees the other way.
Yes.
And one of the things I thought was a good example of radical common sense is that they found the best way to keep at-risk young people in high school was to give them a more challenging curriculum. They didn't drop out because they were stupid or perverse. It was because they were bored.
Bored, right.
And so many things like that. They're talking about how are we going to come up with the money, because this coming year they expect people, it's going to cost $7,000 for health care per head.
Wow.
Per capita. Now, that's plumb crazy.
Yes.
You know, it's somehow, something has to be really wrong here. They're talking about, and I'm very happy to hear all these task forces that are going to try to look into the problem of obesity, especially in children. But it's like an epidemic, and not just here, but in other parts of the world. A friend of mine said, well, seems to me that it could have something to do with the fact that we're eating this meat and poultry that's got the hormones in it that make the cows and
chickens. I'd say.
But politically, that's not a good thing to talk about. But think about it. Think about it. I mean, a lot of the things that we need to deal with might be simpler. Some years ago, I sat on a plane next to a man who was the director of the Jewish Home for the Aged in Detroit or something like that. It was like a major facility, and he'd gone to China for research. And he said, do you know those old people don't break a bone unless they fall off a ladder or something? He said, I don't know if it's the Tai Chi they do every morning in the park or what it is, but they don't break their bones. And so, I mean, some of this, sure, it could be a different kind of a genetic thing, but... Let's have the boldness to look in new places. Anyway, it's more fun. It's contemplating. It's like you don't need a lot of other games if you've got this game.
Absolutely.
Like, are we going to figure this out?
You know, you'd written, Marilyn, about harvesting and developing our talents so that we can reclaim our sovereignty. In fact, by harvesting our own talents, we will reclaim our sovereignty.
Yeah.
That seems
simple enough. I mean, because we will feel... Well, I think there's two things that will make us feel good about ourselves. One is to acquire skills.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is to do the right thing in terms of our, you know, interaction with other people. And that if we... I went through this odd little thing several years ago, where I noticed in myself, but also in just about everybody I knew, that we tend to exaggerate stuff, you know, when we're conversing. And if we hurt ourselves, say you bump your shin, we overreact.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody gives us a piece of bad news, we say some kind of obscenity when it isn't even worth it. And I thought, it's not that bad. So why am I doing that? And I decided to try to quit. It was not easy. I went up to Lake Arrowhead, where I lived part of the time, and spent some time up there because it was easier. And I found that in order to pay attention and to get myself to really notice, I made myself apologize to the furniture that I swore at. You know, just to feel foolish enough about it to wake up to that. And I do a few little things like that. It was just like, that was pretty natural to me when I realized what I was doing, because both, I mean, journalism and science, and I was once a legal secretary. I mean, all those fields really require you to be somewhat accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And at least that's the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that if I pay attention to the little tiny things that are so insignificant that nobody would really hold you deeply responsible if you didn't do the quite perfectly right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that it's that if you do that for a little while, then pretty soon when something comes up, you don't have to ask yourself what to do. And
right.
And there's a kind of, and after a while after that, you go, wow, I can trust myself.
Exactly.
I think when we're little kids, especially, like, we keep getting in trouble, you know, and we feel a little bit guilty. And there's something really good about, like, taking yourself in hand so that you've got, then you can deal with the things that are really sticky.
Absolutely. I think when you were talking about reclaiming our sovereignty and becoming, you know, feeling from our spirit when we're doing the right thing or not, is very important. But also what's important is what you've written about in your book, Aquarius Now, is that we may want to make some changes, personal changes in our lives. And the thing that we need to remember that you've pointed out in the book is that we may want to change a habit, let's say, but we've got three parts of our brain that has to be present when we're trying to control behavior. So we may say, okay, I'm going to stop smoking or drinking.
Right,
or
you can just kind of make a mental note.
Yeah.
That's not going to get you very far.
Right, because maybe you could go into that a little bit because of what we have to actually consider.
Somebody who has some interesting ideas on this is Robert Fritz, who wrote a book called The Path of Least Resistance. And he pointed out that doing things by willpower, like trying to quit smoking or something by willpower, that doesn't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so rigid, it's likely to just crack at any moment. And he gave different examples, but what he suggested is that if you hold in your mind simultaneously the vision of where you'd like to be and where you are, the disparity is like a rubber band that will pull you toward the vision.
Uh-huh.
And it's like using tension in a positive way, the creative tension.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between what you want to see happen and where it is now will draw you towards that ideal. So it's a kind of an interesting thing. I was reminded, just backing up a little bit, Lincoln said, and there's several really famous people who said almost the same thing word for word, what makes me, let's see, when I do good, well, I feel good, and when I do bad, I feel bad. That's
mm-hmm.
my religion.
Mm-hmm.
That, so what that presupposes, though, that you brought up, is that you have to be feeling it.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's something that maybe everybody can kind of work on it. And it might not be a bad idea to go to some tear-jerker movies and put yourself in situations where you want to.
Yeah, we're almost out of time, and it would be lovely to leave our listeners with the idea of actually think about what it is you would like to accomplish, something that's out, nothing that you have now, but something outside of your box, and start visualizing that and watch how you're
walking. And know that you can do it.
Know that you can do it.
Know that you can do it.
Yes.
I mean, because you're wanting to do it is going to be like this huge impetus. And, you know, it isn't so much that God helps those who help themselves. God helps those who commit themselves.
Commit yourself. And when you're visualizing what you want, as Marilyn just said, you feel what it feels like to already have it.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I call that remembering the future.
I like
it. As if it's an experience, not just a sketch.
Yes. So when you incorporate the visual and the feeling, And the emotions will come up to the excitement of having accomplished it. And I think the universe answers our call much faster.
And just to notice, I mean, be a coach to yourself and be a good parent to yourself. Notice the things that keep your spirits high.
Yes.
And you know, you manage yourself. You know the way you work and do that on behalf of, because it's not like the thing you're doing is some big altruistic gesture, noble
right.
gesture. It will be your joy in the making of you.
And we live longer when we're optimistic.
Uh-huh.
We live longer. We have, you know, a healthier heart when we're happier and we're optimistic rather than.
So that makes the optimist right in a way.
Yeah.
Right. If it works that way for them.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was Ford said one time, it doesn't matter whether you think you can or you think you can't. You're right either way.
Yes. There you go. Marilyn, I want to thank you for this lovely interview and for your incredible work, your new book, Aquarius Now, Radical Common Sense and Reclaiming Our Personal Sovereignty.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Thank you for joining us and sharing your wisdom again. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Dr. Anne West. I'll be back next week with more truth from the source. Join me again on bbsradio.com every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'll bring you more cutting-edge interviews discussing important life, health, environmental, and metaphysical issues that could affect the well-being of our lives. Dr. Anne West at www.drannewest.com. See you next week.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.